This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
Dr. Thorning, it's a great honor to welcome you to the program. Let's get right to it. Let me ask you, what is cap and trade? And based on your research, is this a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, a cap and trade is a way of forcing companies and households to reduce their use of fossil fuels. The plan would, such as the Waxman-Markey bill, it was voted out of the House in June of last year, would require the U.S. to gradually ratchet down greenhouse gas emissions, including CO2, by 43% compared to 2005 levels by the year 2030, and by 2050 by 82%. So it would require pretty much decarbonizing the U.S. economy. So the target emissions get smaller and smaller every year. So industry has and households have to find a way to cut their use of fossil fuels, or they have to pay under a cap-and-trade system a very large amount for purchasing an emission credit from some company that's managed to reduce its emissions, maybe because it shut in production or found some less carbon-intensive way to produce its goods and services. You can purchase the right each year to emit a ton of CO2. Now, we at the American Council for Capital Formation did an analysis of the economic impact of the Waxman-Markey bill using the Department of Energy's own National Energy Modeling System. And these results are available at www.accf.org. And our results show that as the Waxman-Markey targets get tighter and tighter, so that emissions have to fall by more and more every year, the price of a permit that a company would have to pay to emit a ton of carbon would rise by the year 2020 to between $48 and $61 a ton. So that's the amount a utility or a manufacturing company or an energy producer would have to pay for every ton of CO2 they emit. By 2030, when the targets get really tight, and of course U.S. population is increasing, each extra person needs one a little bit more energy, by 2030 the price of a carbon permit would be between $123 a ton and $159 a ton. So that's what pushes up the price of energy, because energy producers have to pay for every ton of CO2 that their coal that they produce emits. Utilities have to pay for CO2 they emit. Manufacturers do too. And they pass on these price of a carbon permit that they have to pay into the electricity and other energy prices that consumers and businesses have to pay.
We're talking with Dr. Margot Thorning of the American Council for Capital Formation. She's Senior Vice President and the Chief Economist. The website is accf.org. So under the existing cap and trade that's been proposed, the cost for fossil fuel energy to the consumer, we can your studies show that it's basically going to go through the roof.
Well, it's going to go up very substantially. Energy prices rise on average. For example, the price of gasoline goes up by approximately 25% compared to the baseline forecast by 2030. The price of electricity goes up, you know, depending on whether we ran two cases, a high-cost case and a low-cost case, and the difference between those two cases is how quickly new technology can penetrate the economy, like how much new nuclear, how much carbon capture and storage, so that we can burn coal and natural gas and capture and store the carbon. These cases vary by how quickly the new technology penetrates, but electricity prices rise by as much as 70% for some areas of the country if they're more coal dependent. Natural gas prices rise by as much as 70% by 2030. So it's a very large increase in energy prices, energy derived from fossil fuel, and that's the intent of the bill.
Well, that was my next question. Isn't that the whole goal, is to make fossil fuel-based energy prohibitively expensive so that the consumer is forced to consider other options.
That's correct. And, of course, the Waxman-Markey bill also included provisions to require much more use of renewable energy from solar and wind and biomass. It also has in it provisions to require significant increases in energy efficiency. And so we modeled those three provisions, the cap and trade part, the energy efficiency, and the renewable portfolio standard for electricity generation. And those three things substantially raise the cost of energy. So that's what depresses gross the growth in gross domestic product and the fact that job growth slows compared to the baseline forecast. For example, by 2030, when the free allowances, you know, the bill initially gives away many of the allowances that companies need to for carbon permits, but by 2030, they're no longer giving them away, and companies have to pay for all of their allowances virtually. And by 2030, we show job loss compared to the baseline between 1.8 million fewer jobs in 2030 to as many as 2.4 million fewer jobs. So that's quite a significant loss of jobs, and GDP growth slows by between 1.8 and 2.4%. You may think that's not a lot, 2.4% less GDP, but 2.4% is $600 billion a year, and that's what we're currently paying our Social Security recipients. So if we reduce our GDP by $600 billion in 2030, the federal and state government budgets will be impacted because they get about 30 cents together of every dollar of U.S. GDP. So federal and state tax receipts will drop by about $200 billion that year. So it's a very significant loss of income compared to the baseline forecast.
Dr. Margot Thorning is with us. She's the Senior Vice President and the Chief Economist for the American Council for Capital Formation. The website is accf.org, with some recent results of her analysis of the proposed cap and trade. So clearly from where you sit and the numbers tell you, this is not really a good idea. What then would be the a proposal then? Is there a proposal, an alternative proposal, for how you might make something like this work and not cause that kind of damage to the economy?
Well, listeners need to be aware that climate change is a global issue. It is not a state or U.S. issue. In fact, China now emits more greenhouse gas emissions every year than the U.S. does, and that their emissions are projected to grow between 7 to 10% a year. So if we want to address, if we want to slow the growth of greenhouse gas emissions, it must be a global effort. And the developing countries, which is where most of the growth in emissions is coming from, have to be part of the, have to be involved, because without their curbing their emissions, what we do here in the U.S. will do nothing. Now, there are some strategies that I think we ought to put more focus on. For one thing, we need to use cost-benefit analysis as we adopt a policy here in the U.S. What is the cost of this initiative and what are the benefits? The environmental benefits, according of the Waxman-Markey bill, are almost negligible. This is Lisa Jackson, the EPA administrator, testified this fall before the Senate Energy Committee. If the U.S. reduces its emissions to zero, it really won't matter by the end of this century, because developing countries are swamping us with their emission growth. So when you look at the cost of the proposal, which is between 1.8 and 2.4% of GDP in 2030, and you look at the benefits, to me, the costs substantially exceed the benefits, because there's no virtually no global environmental benefit. So another approach would be to continue to expand our knowledge of how to capture and store carbon so that the U.S. can burn its coal supply without emitting CO2, can burn its increasingly large natural gas supply without emitting CO2. We need more R&D on that. We need to improve the U.S. tax code, because we have the slowest depreciation for new investment and about the highest corporate tax rate in the industrial world. So that means the cost of new investment here is higher than in other countries who have more favorable for investment tax codes. We need to promote nuclear power for electricity generation because that's a carbon-free source of electricity, and we will need more electricity. And finally, we need to work with the institutions that were developed during the previous administration, the Asia-Pacific Partnership for Economic Development and Clean Energy, the Major Economies Initiative. And these, the Major Economies Initiative consists of the 17 countries that emit 85% of the globe's greenhouse gas emissions. And the purpose of those organizations is to transfer existing technology, to transfer best practices for coal mining, aluminum production, cement production, renewable energy, and other major sources of industrial emissions. So we need to work with these international groups to try to come up with common solutions. It's pretty clear from what happened at the Copenhagen meetings before Christmas, which ended in a very weak, toothless agreement between some of the larger countries, the Copenhagen Accord. It's pretty clear that countries know they have to have more energy to grow, and they're not willing to bind themselves to mandatory targets and emission reductions because they will, A, lose competitiveness, and, B, not grow as fast because each one, for example, in the U.S., each 1% increase in gross domestic product is accompanied by a 0.2% increase in energy use. So energy use and economic growth are tightly bound, and even though we're becoming more energy efficient with every passing year, and we use less energy every year to produce a dollar of output, still you can't grow without energy use, and that's even more true in developing countries.
We're talking with Dr. Margot Thorning, Senior Vice President and Chief Economist for the American Council for Capital Formation. You can read her work online at accf.org. Before we let you go, what are your thoughts about the this talk in Washington about regulating greenhouse gases and making this the EPA stepping in and providing some type of regulation?
Well, that's a good question. And the Environmental Protection Agency is preparing to regulate greenhouse gas emissions under the Clean Air Act. And they are about to issue a recommendation for regulating emissions from light-duty vehicles. I think that's expected in March. And if they do that, then that will mean not only that light-duty vehicles will be regulated, but it will automatically trigger stationary source emissions from factories and utilities. They would not use a tool like a cap-and-trade system or like a carbon tax. They would simply say, you must adopt the best available technology and get your emissions down. Now, the problem with that is, in many cases, there isn't technology that would enable companies or utilities to quickly get their emissions down. They would, and there's no fine that you can pay in order to keep operating. They might simply have to cut production. They would certainly have to switch fuels from coal to natural gas or some other fuel. So it would be quite an expensive, very bureaucratic way of trying to slow the growth in U.S. greenhouse gas emissions. And, of course, going back to my original point of the use of cost-benefit analysis, if you look at the cost of this program, which would be huge, and you look at the benefits are negligible because U.S. emissions are an ever-shrinking share of the global total. So based on cost-benefit analysis, it would be not a good idea for the EPA to regulate greenhouse gas emissions.
Dr. Margot Thorning of the American Council for Capital Formation, Senior Vice President and Chief Economist and an internationally recognized expert on tax, environmental, and competitiveness issues, joins us this afternoon. Margot, thank you so much for spending some time with us and sharing the results of your analyses with us. We appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Absolutely. You can read her work online at accf.org. The very latest numbers on the true impacts, the long-term impacts of proposed cap and trade, and also her thoughts about the EPA stepping in and regulating greenhouse gases under the Clean Air Act.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit SeavillePodcast.com for more.